You're listening to the ILLA podcast, the online home of lectures and conversations hosted by the Institute for International Law and the Humanities at the Melbourne Law School.
So, welcome everyone. I'd like to just briefly acknowledge the traditional owners of the unceded land upon which we're meeting today and pay our respects to elders past, present and future. My name is Laura Peterson, and it's my delight to have been asked to chair this session today. I'm a postdoctoral fellow at the University of Lucerne in Switzerland, but I've been working remotely, and so I've been lucky to still be associated with ILLA here as a visiting fellow. And it's my great pleasure to introduce to you today Dr. Daniel Ricardo Curiroca Villamarin. Good to see you again in Melbourne. We just first met about 5 years ago when Daniel was here on exchange here at MLS and I was writing my doctorate. And we most recently met up in Switzerland again at a conference in Lucerne. So Daniel is originally from Colombia and did his prize-winning graduate studies, his MA and his PhD in Geneva in international law at the Graduate Institute of International and Development Studies. And so he received his doctorate earlier this year, so congratulations again. And today he's going to present on some of his PhD work, which was titled Architects of the Better World. So I understand Daniel's going to now speak to us for approximately 15, 20 minutes, and then we'll have plenty of time for discussion and questions about his work. So over to you.
Wonderful. Now, it's so nice to be back, especially after 5 years. I have especially very fond memories of this room and the reading groups in this room. So it's very, very exciting to now get to share with you what I hope will be my book project. And precisely because of that, any comments, suggestions, incisive kind of concerns are more than welcome. And as Laura well said, I titled the book project Architects of the Better World, Democracy, Law, and the Construction of International Order. And I take that first sentence from a speech that the UNCCN President Truman delivers, well, really to wire, but let's say he gives to the 1945 San Francisco Conference of International Organization, in which he urged the delegates participating in this fundamental conference to see themselves in their work creating this organization as architects of the better world. And I just thought it was a very good example of the ways in which scholars from my own field, international law, but also neighboring fields in international history, international relations, tend to use metaphors that come from architecture and geography to make sense of the international. We often imagine it as an edifice with areas and pillars. And that I wanted to do then in this project was to take this kind of metaphor seriously. I think, what if we think actually of the architecture of international cooperation, to use a kind of widely recurrent sentence in her work, but take it seriously as an object of study, of inquiry. And this is part of a kind of broader agenda I've been pursuing for the last couple of years, including when I was here, which has been part of thinking, how could a more materialist history of international law look like? How could we decenter maybe the very important work we were doing on intellectual histories, conceptual histories, and rather think, what if we put commodities, infrastructures at the foreground of the narrative? And for that reason, when I was doing my master's also here, one thing I was very concerned about was shipping containers and their role in international law. And this kind of project takes that in a very different direction, sort of methodological and theoretical connections. But the object of inquiry at the end, I felt, was much closer to the hearts and minds of public international lawyers. And it is the spaces that we often go to work and to toil that we either love to hate or hate to love. And in particular, what I wanted to do was to put the work in conversation with a broader kind of tradition of Foucauldian work on the birth of particular institutions, the birth of the clinic, most famously, the birth of the prison. Because I thought it was a good way of thinking more concretely about the relationship between very kind of material spaces, buildings, and the kind of wider discursive ideological projects in which they're linked in. And I think you cannot see it entirely over here, but the kind of central theoretical metaphor, or theoretical idea I want to mobilize in this book project is what I call the international parliamentary complex. And it is the idea that these spaces really function as if they were some sort of parliaments of nations in which the whole community comes to deliberate as if it were an European parliament in which domestic peoples come to deliberate. And I take really this kind of language from the sources I was working with. This is Victor Horta, a very famous Belgian architect, in a way, the protagonist of the Geneva chapter we're going to be discussing in a second. And you see him using here this language in French, that the task ahead, and this was in his capacity as chairman of the jury of architects of the League of Nations new building, is to create a parliament of nations. And in English, in French, in German, in different languages throughout the 20th century, this is the kind of language that is used to think of the task of the League of Nations and later the United Nations in particular. So with this in mind, what I wanted to do in the book project, or the argument I'm putting forward, and this is very difficult to read, I'm sorry, but this is, of course, the very famous 14 points of the U.S. President Wilson's kind of program for peace, is that this kind of idea of the first point, that after the Great War, we needed open covenants of peace, publicly negotiated, is not only an ideological project, but it's very concretely an architectural project. You need spaces where you can do public diplomacy. And those are, I argue, in the dissertation and the book project, these new parliaments created precisely to hold this sort of kind of diplomatic encounters. So basically, these are the sort of questions I wanted to ask throughout the project. How did this kind of new diplomacy, and I refer this to the kind of post-World Great War diplomacy, was produced and co-produced by this idea of the European domestic parliament as a template for interpolity or international relations? Secondly, well, what resources and constraints did those spaces then impose on the people like us, perhaps, that toil in there and pursue lawmaking and normative projects within them? But then finally, and perhaps most importantly, well, then were there the hierarchies and the biases, the blind spots that we can see in the palaces of the international community, and how do they reflect a particular idea of who belongs to it and who doesn't really get to participate? What I wanted to do, or what I did throughout the project, was to start in the book or the manuscript, just like today, with a kind of chapter on metaphors and the work they do and the way we think about global order. This is then followed by an historiographical chapter that tries to make a broad argument about what I would like to call a shift in European kind of diplomacies. From a more aristocratic tradition of congressing, think for instance of the Congress of Vienna, 1815, very monarchical, very bilateral, a lot of partying, alcohol, drinks, very fun perhaps, but I want to argue that there's a fundamental change to a kind of more bureaucratic, legalized, multilateral form of diplomacy that will start, for instance, in places like The Hague, in the Hague conferences of the late 1907, but especially the Paris Peace Conference, I argue, is this kind of watershed moment of this new kind of juridified form of diplomacy, taking that idea of juridification of international relations from Gary Simpson's work. And then this kind of sets the stage for the dissertation proper. And what I do is then to explore different instances of parliament making, to put it in those terms, in which new kind of palaces for the international community were erected, beginning with Geneva, with the building of the International Labour Organization, nowadays the World Trade Organization, and that's a wonderful metaphor in its own terms, but I'll kind of park that for a second, going throughout the kind of main building of the League of Nations in Geneva, and that's the one I kindly shared with Laura and I would like us to maybe focus on today. But I want to kind of highlight where the project goes afterwards, Geneva. It is followed by the kind of big famous UN headquarters in Manhattan, kind of seeing how similar debates to those that unfolded in the League in Geneva then happened in the context of the United Nations after the Second World War. But I also wanted to put in conversation kind of regional parliaments and regional spaces of international order. And that's why the next two chapters focus on a conference in Bogota, 1948, that led to the creation of the Organization of American States. And I counterpose that with Africa Hall in Addis Abeba, where the Organization of African Unity was created. Finally, I come back to Europe, to the kind of third big workstation of the UN in Vienna, and I conclude then with a kind of epilogue on the 90s and the great promise of the post-Cold War diplomacy. Vienna 93, Rome 98, and especially the kind of promise and peril of civil society participation in those kind of late Cold War or post-Cold War kind of summits. That's the kind of broader arc of the dissertation. And as I mentioned, I think today I would like to kind of focus on Geneva in particular. How did I do this? Well, I think a big part of the project was to pursue international legal history internationally and to take very seriously the challenge of then working with different archives, with different materials, with different languages, and going beyond what I thought would be a story that would only be based in New York or Geneva, for instance. That implied that this was how most of the project looked like. This is the Rockefeller Reading Room in Geneva, and most of the kind of approach was doing the kind of following the cues of a very established tradition of legal history, of going to memorandum, treaties, different kind of documents to make sense of the political disputes behind these spaces. But of course, working with architecture and buildings also implied a kind of very different set of challenges. Sometimes working with architectural plans, with photographs, with private correspondence of architects, particularly Horta in this chapter, plays an important role. Above all, it played a challenge of working with languages I'm not particularly good at. German and Amharic, really, kind of the forefront of that challenge, especially Amharic. But I wanted to kind of take that kind of challenge to really think how a more global history of international law could look like. And that's part of a broader conversation I think we've been having. So just to kind of wrap up this initial kind of exploration, in sum, I think what I want to do in this project are kind of three different things. On the one hand, methodologically, to think seriously about how we can open up space, some pun intended, for space in the history of international law. Secondly, from a more theoretical perspective, by thinking carefully of what it means to parliamentarize international relations, I want to think carefully about the ways in which legal rituals, legal procedures, the idea that we kind of meet in committees with a draft agenda, et cetera, are fundamental to the way that we understand modern, juridified, kind of routine bureaucratic diplomacy. But then finally, from a historical contribution, I guess this is also a kind of very heterodox history of international organizations. You have the kind of traditional markers, 1919, 1945, the end of the Cold War. And something I was very committed was on bringing the kind of 20th century together in ways that I didn't see we were doing very well in the literature. But partially by kind of making that very traditional narrative, but placing it from a different perspective that foregrounds the architects and the kind of lawyers doing the lead work behind these buildings and not necessarily the typical kind of great intellectual figures, I think we see kind of international organizations differently. And that has been a big part of the commitment of the project. So now in the kind of 5 minutes I have left, I just wanted to kind of zoom in very quickly in Geneva. So just to tell you the background, the kind of previous chapter before Geneva makes this kind of contrast between an old style form of diplomacy and a new style, more bourgeois form of diplomacy. This is, of course, an exaggeration. One can see that many elements of the aristocratic closed doors form of diplomatic encounters continue to persist in our world, and I'll talk about that in a second. But I did think that it's heuristically helpful to think of this as kind of different traditions, above all cultural traditions in diplomacy. Another way to think about it is it's the age of suits. We don't really see suits in Vienna. That's really not the thing we're talking about. We see very particular kind of aristocratic dressings. But same thing I do in this chapter with this very famous image from Augustander, the three young farmers going to a dance as part of his collection on the man of the 20th century. And I think that's particularly telling. I try to make an argument that this is what's going to be very distinctive, not only of the diplomacy I'm interested in, but of the places I'm going to be interested in, the kind of people who attend and engage in those spaces. But I'll just now switch to Geneva very quickly. So first, before we have the Palais des Nations chapter, I talk a little bit about this ILO site. I talk about how it was donated by the kind of federal and local Swiss authorities. This is the kind of Lake of Geneva. On front, you see the Mont Blanc. This is really prime real estate. And basically what I tried to show is how the kind of initial construction of this new building for the International Labour Organization, BIP, you see the French initials, was a kind of complement to the already existing kind of interim headquarters of the League. It's over here, is then in French. And here in this kind of lots was the initial question in which a new building for the League of Nations was going to be erected. And that's what I want to focus in today in particular. I then not only kind of look at the questions surrounding the land, and that's why this image is important. Those of you familiar with Geneva know that at the end, this is not where the League of Nations was located. It was moved uphill, but the idea of making it here was a big part of the conversation. But because we have a short amount of time, I really wanted to focus on the architectural competition and the debate surrounding the architectural competition of this Palais des Nations, because it's a central concern in architectural history, and my sense is that as international legal historians and scholars, we had a lot to learn from that. So in particular, I kind of highlight that one of the problems with Geneva is that the so-called Protestant Rome, and Geneva was full of Calvinist imaginary, it still is, was really didn't really have fitting infrastructure for a diplomatic conferencing. They didn't have good spaces for the kind of secretariats of these organizations. But in particular, when it came to these big kind of parliamentary assemblies for which now the League of Nations is famous, this is, for instance, the image of the first League Assembly in 1920, you see that this is really a disaster. It was held in a place called the Salle de la Reformation, very associated with a very particular Calvinist tradition in Geneva, and everyone had complaints about this particular kind of meeting space. So I tried to highlight that this is why it's very important that they took the effort to create this new palace for the organization. And I really tried to show that this was a central concern, not only for architects, but for a lot of the kind of leading figures of the period. So this is just a kind of random assortment of different archival files. We see, for instance, Hudley Motz, a very famous kind of American law professor, sending a personal letter to Eric Drummond asking to add a Carillon tower to the palace. We have a telegram from Mussolini kind of stating that he really was interested in this and he had questions about the architects, etc. Up there we have a donation that the British government does to the organization saying that because Great Britain was the mother of parliamentary democracy, it's difficult to say that without laughing, then they were going to provide the kind of technical infrastructure for the acoustics of this new building. So what I'm trying to show you is this is not a kind of marginal concern. This was something in which Eric Drummond, important lawyers, kind of leading statespeople, diplomats, saw that it was a representative question for the organization. And in particular, what I wanted to do in the Geneva chapter was, as I mentioned, foreground the kind of tragic figure, in a way, of Victor Horta. So Belgium had tried to steal the League of Nations to Brussels. They didn't really manage that, and that's an interesting story I'm just bracketing. They did get the first presidency of the League of Nations Council, and by the same token, they got the presidency of the kind of jury of architects. And it is true, this kind of figure of Victor Horta and the kind of decisions he took in that capacity, where I'm really trying to foreground the kind of questions of the period. This is, you see, just Horta in the background of his own personal house, now his museum and archives in Brussels, beautiful, kind of interesting Art Deco place. He also made, for instance, the maintain station in Brussels, so really kind of a leading kind of architect of the Belgian political establishment. And what I'm trying to show is that really he sits in a way in the middle between two different traditions of the jury of architects. And that is not only a kind of issue for an aesthetical consideration or from the perspective of architectural history, but also from a kind of political division between the powers sitting in the committee. Because what I tried to highlight is that as the jury began to evaluate the different proposals, it becomes very clear that the jury is kind of very strongly separated into two camps. On the one hand, you would have what modern architects have called the more academic, traditional kind of faction, very close to the interest of the kind of great powers of the time, France and Great Britain, for kind of a very particular idea of how the architecture of this building should look like, usually inspired by either neoclassical or Gothic models. Remember that in this time, really kind of late 19th century, early 20th century, if you did a parliament, it was either Gothic or neoclassic, basically. That was the kind of imagination what they thought would be dignified for the organization. And on the other hand, you have a kind of rising faction of younger, usually, architects from smaller polities, called mostly from Switzerland, as being very important in the German-speaking context, that try to, Joseph Hoffmann from Austria, above all, for instance, that really try to think differently about how the kind of league building should look like. And in particular, they're going to be read as the kind of allies of modern architecture in this struggle. I then showed that the reason why this kind of competition is so infamous in architectural history is because of the involvement of Le Corbusier, the very famous French-Swiss architect, because he and his cousin, Pierre Jeanneret, very famously made a proposal, you see here an initial sketch of how the league would look like. And those who are familiar with the actual building in Geneva, you know that it looks nothing like that. Because conversely, or as an opposition to Le Corbusier, what usually the committee got were a series of more traditional neoclassical or Gothic projects. So this is one, for instance, submitted by Brogi, an important architect who would later actually come to make the building. So I just wanted to counterpose a little bit that kind of distinction, because you do see kind of very striking different visions of how they thought the league should look like and what it represented for the post-war world. So what I do in the chapter is really foreground how, through this kind of tension between these visions of what the league should represent, the law plays a very important role. Basically, precisely because there's a tie between the members of the jury, Horta, as the president, gets to have the casting vote, as is this word, like the ICJ or something like that. And basically, Horta says, I cannot take a decision. Why? Because the law does not allow me to. Neither of the proposals, neither the modernist like Corbusier, neither the traditionalist, have complied with the reglement to the kind of, let's say, exact as they should. And that is why I cannot do this, but it should be rather Eric Drummond and the Secretariat, those who should rule in the exception and kind of decide who should kind of make the building. And what I show in the chapter, and I'm just going very quickly through it now, is that this was an enormous scandal. Eventually, of course, Le Corbusier and the kind of more modernist proposals were disregarded, and we got the kind of building that you see now and that is now very emblematic in Geneva as a kind of very particular thing. But I just wanted to conclude showing that, of course, in this controversy, law played a very important role. Le Corbusier and his allies in the modern movement did not only publish very incisive and, let's say, destructive books and pamphlets about the League of Nations and its role. Here you see his very famous Un Masson in Palais kind of book, which really responds to this controversy, and some of the pamphlets that he circulated among the kind of French intelligentsia in relation to architecture, saying how much the kind of jury had mistreated modern architecture and Le Corbusier in particular. But as an international legal scholar and historian, I was particularly interested in this kind of last document. And it's really a formal suit that Le Corbusier files through a very famous French international lawyer, André Proudhon, to try to sue the League of Nations, to try to say the problem here is that you are not living to the same expectations of legality that as an organization you're putting forward. And he tries then to bring the League into account. At the end, this fails, interestingly so, because the League Secretariat concludes that individuals have no standing in international law. This is interesting because how people usually think of the interwar period is that this is the moment in which individuals started to have standing in international law, but at least Le Corbusier as an architect did not have standing. And that is why we kind of end up with the building we have, which I'll just show you for a second. In just one last kind of minute, I wanted to conclude with this particular painting. This is called The Lesson of Salamanca, donated by the Spanish polity, a very difficult moment just before the Civil War, to kind of commemorate, you don't really see him here, but underneath here you would see a Spanish cleric, which is meant to represent Francisco de Vitoria. And what the lesson of Salamanca means is the kind of influence or the teachings of the Spanish polity for international law. I don't go into too much detail on this in the dissertation, but I did publish a kind of separate working paper if anyone is interested. But what I tried to highlight with this kind of lesson of Salamanca is that in this particular context of the Spanish Civil War and the crisis of the League, this painting becomes particularly problematic because its painter becomes a kind of partisan of the Franco side in the Spanish Civil War. And what we have is then this kind of massive homage to peace in the most inner sanctuary of the League of Nations, made and commissioned by a fascist painter and a fascist government. And I conclude with that because I think it's just one of the many examples that the League's kind of material history is not a stranger to what's happening in international relations in the interwar period. This is just another example. This is a famous French magazine that did a special issue when the Palais was inaugurated. It was beautiful. You see the building, you see the famous peacocks, etc. But you also see that in the same issue, they had to run a number about the Anschluss of Austria into the Greater German Project. So in a way, what I'm trying to say is that this kind of conversations around the built environment and its limitations are not happening in kind of separation to the questions regarding international politics, but especially international law and international organizations. I think I would like to stop here so we can rather have a conversation. I did bring slides of the different other chapters, so if we have time, if people have particular questions about New York or Vienna or Addis or Bogota, we can go into that. But I think I'd like to stop now and give Laura the floor.
Thank you. That was a very speedy run through, but very enlightening. Thank you. I've had the pleasure of reading that Geneva chapter. So I have some questions for you while everyone else can prepare their own thoughts and questions. So maybe I'll start and then feel free to also jump in. I know that you were studying in Geneva and that the Graduate Institute was right in a villa that was up right next to where the original site, the League of Nations, was. I'm just curious about how this all fits in as a local story as well as an international story. But more than that, like, thanks to the outline of the methodology and the archival work, I think something really interesting is happening here because it's a question of how to write this history when a key part of kind of understanding these buildings is being in that place and being at that site at a certain time. And so I'm kind of interested in how you can bring that into this project, because these buildings aren't sort of neutral, they're not static, and we shape buildings too when we're in them. So I'm just interested in perhaps your experience yourself of being in that League of Nations building, because I know that you've titled the chapter, it's a labyrinth, it's a tomb, there's very loaded descriptions there. But beyond that kind of response, how do we actually capture that element of experience and that moment when we're trying to do this type of legal history?
No, I think that when it comes to kind of engaging with, you know, the architecture and the built environment, there's kind of many different traditions and approaches. And I think that the one that you're describing in a way I would call more phenomenological, and it's the kind of individual going to the space and kind of engaging with it. And I've been very well informed, or very much informed, by the work that, for instance, some colleagues in Amsterdam, for instance, around the legal sightseeing project are doing. And I think that's the kind of approach they're taking. You walk to Brussels, you feel the environment, and that's part of it. I think I wanted to do something a little bit differently. I mean, of course, not to say that being in Geneva didn't have an impact. Of course, this is very much a project that is trying to make sense of my own history and how did I come to be in these places, and why do we take these kind of lakeside locations as important and not kind of others? So there's definitely something very deeply autobiographical in every project, I think. But I guess that I did want to take what I would call a more kind of structural approach and really seeing, well, what do the sources tell me about what people thought about these spaces? Mm-hmm. And I think you can do the two things at the same time. I think I have my own take of these buildings, but I think for the purpose of this project, I was really trying to see, well, what did Drummond think of this building? What did Horta think of this building? And why? Because, of course, the kind of challenge there, and this relates to a difficult conversation we'd be having among with some colleagues here in Melbourne, is the kind of fear of anachronism. We're imposing kind of on your sources your own kind of take on this. And I, on print and in person, being very committed not to do that and to take sources very seriously. So that's why I would distinguish between these two kind of modes of engagement.
Yeah, Daniel, what a fascinating project. Illa is delighted to have you back. We had a great time last time, and it's terrific to have you back in Melbourne. And we've talked about some of these issues, but also about other areas of international law. And I note your recent edited collection on international organisations, which is another great contribution to the field. I'm interested in the location of these international organisations. So you've pointed to Geneva, and I'd like to hear more about that transition between the International Labour Organization to the World Trade Organization headquarters, if you've done particular research on that question. But also in Geneva, we have the World Meteorological Organization up on the hill near the Palais des Nations. So there's these kind of flags of important issues to the international community. And I'd be interested to hear a bit more about the fragmentation aspect, which we've talked about in the past, and particularly on the environment question, where a United Nations Environment Programme, not an international organisation, gets placed in Nairobi, Kenya. And that's a reflection of the time and also the ambition to bring, you know, a more holistic kind of world organisation to the issue of environment, but also had that impact of marginalising the environment further, and it's the sort of peripheral thing that Geneva considers sometimes, and then some of the UNEP people come over and get based in Geneva. But then we have the WMO increasingly important, given climate change is now on the international radar, where it should have been for a long time. So I just wondered if you could reflect a little bit on that fragmentation aspect in the work that you're doing.
But in case, I mean, I'll just kind of outline the story, but in case anyone is kind of more interested in that ILOW transition, that's actually the only part of the dissertation that has come published in an architectural journal, and that was an interesting experience in about itself, but that's the reference. But basically what happened is that at some point it became clear that the ILO had grown too big. I mean, part of the story is also of growth of organizations and how they grow in ways that people, when they created them, can never really anticipate. And basically, the Geneva or the Swiss and local authorities authorized extra money to create a new massive building for the ILO up the hill. And this kind of, the kind of place that was originally built in the 20s, it's kind of left there behind, and they're not really sure what to do with it. So first the GATT moves in, then the actual library of my institute, so definitely very kind of entangled in different ways. And it is later when really the GATT moves in that they kind of realize, well, this is a weird building for us, you know, because it's full of this kind of socialist artwork. I don't know if I brought any of the pictures here. No, I didn't. Well, in this article, I do work quite carefully with two paintings in particular. And a big part is just like, this is this kind of interwar socialistic, you know, friends of labor kind of thing. And this doesn't really work with how we imagine international trade. So actually, and I don't remember now the name of his name, but one of the GATT directors, also very involved with the institute, decides to kind of layer things up and kind of really cover them. And there's only quite later with Pascal Lamy as Director General of the WTO, that they kind of realize that they're not the bad guys and they should embrace that they're kind of in the same boat as the kind of labor guys and the environmental guys. And they actually kind of recover their past heritage by uncovering the building, and they find paintings that were lost. And in particular here, there's good work by anthropologists on this, on how the kind of WTO came to refine itself in a way. And I think that speaks part to the kind of fragmentation story. I think what I would say about fragmentation is what I found very interesting is that none of these associations we make with the cities are givens. They were created by people who invested very seriously in that. They invested ideologically, they invested materially, because there's no reason why The Hague should be the piece of international justice, or I think that's the slogan, whereas Geneva is the kind of institutional bureaucratic city. The Viennese were like, we are the, you know, nuclear and security people, you know, the drugs and police. So what I'm trying to highlight is this conscious effort of different people, different institutions have kind of rebranding self in that way. And Nairobi is really the kind of missing part of the dissertation in a way. That's a question I got in La Trobe, I think maybe Alex remembers. And in an initial kind of table of contents, Nairobi was there, definitely. The thing is that the fourth kind of UN office, which is Nairobi, kind of really entered quite late, especially the kind of purpose design building, which is all about kind of embodying habitat in a way with the kind of green infrastructure, etc., was rebuilt in the 2000s. So it kind of slipped out of the project in a way. But I think you're right that kind of gamble of saying, well, we want to bring these things to the South also kind of had the implication that then you're not in the circles of power that you would be if you're in Geneva or in New York.
Thank you so much. Such a remarkable project. And I love the way you've brought in all of those sort of side projects. So every time we're writing something and we go off into all these rabbit holes that you've managed to sort of cover off and explore, it's really exciting. Congratulations. I've got so many questions. I'm going to try and just stay to some. I love the way you sort of travel the world with all those different cities and develop your thesis through those different places. But I'm also curious to know the extent to which, even within Geneva, for example, where you see, and this is related, I guess, to the point that you were making, you see all of these different buildings mushrooming up over time and representing the sort of purpose of these different organisations. And I just wondered to what extent you'd sort of traced the development of your thesis that you take through the whole book, through those different places, in the one place. And Geneva seems to be a really interesting place from that perspective. And I'm sort of also, I'm not quite sure how it's interesting, but the fact that, you know, Switzerland's neutral and that sort of neutral space in which these things evolve is really interesting to me too. So that was sort of one question. And the other thing, which I think you've sort of partly answered with your discussion around the WTO point, but that dissonance between the sort of the images on the wall, for if you like, and the sort of mission or purpose of the organisation and how that's resolved, I think is really fascinating. And, I mean, you've given the sort of, I don't know, the good example of where the WTO mission gets sort of transformed to a sort of socialist vision.
Mm.
But, of course, your other example of the fascist iconography and all the rest of it is has the potential to go in the other direction. So I'm just sort of curious too to sort of understand your sort of understanding of that. dissonance, I guess, for a word.
No, thank you very much, Alice. And I'll just go very quickly to the table of contents. The more I think about this project, the more I think that each of these kind of different cities could be a monograph in itself.
Yeah.
No, really, they all kind of are so rich. And yeah. I had like to make so much difficult decisions of where to cut and how to cut. Mm-hmm. And but I think you're right that there's, if the one place that gets a little bit more of sunlight, it's Geneva, in particular because part of my argument, and maybe it's a self-serving argument because I was there, but is that everyone is looking back to Geneva. Mm-hmm. So in New York, the first thing they do is they send a mission of architects to see how that's working and how that's unfolding. In Austria, the Austrian consulate submits a very detailed, kind of very Austrian report of all these different buildings in Geneva and what they like, what they didn't like, who were the architects, were there a competition or not. So for better or worse, they kind of great Geneva experiment is a kind of benchmark against things were measured. That said, I don't really look how much of how that international Geneva grew in its own terms, with one exception, and it is that in the Vienna chapter, I try to go back to an expansion of a particular building in Geneva, which is basically the UNCTAD building. Mm-hmm. Well, that's how it was seen at the time, the United Nations Conference on Trade and Development. That building, DIE, if I remember correctly, because that is a kind of part of the same, let's say, genealogy, or the same kind of generation, I think that's the right word, of kind of 60s, very pro-facing, pro-South-facing organizations. And that's why when they wanted to make Vienna, they kind of needed to have kind of UNCTAD in the framework. But I think you're right that a kind of other complete different monograph is just to stay in one of these places and just sit there and see how history comes through, and you would have a lot of things going on. Mm-hmm. And I think that relates to your second question in a way, and is the way in which these images are kind of read and misread and then kind of change throughout time. I think that what I found very interesting about the fascist image, the CERT mural, is that the kind of official League of Nations, United Nations Office in Geneva policy is that doesn't really happen. It doesn't really matter. So, I mean, it's still fun. It's still nice. It's called the Francisco Vittoria Room, but we don't really want to talk about the details. I mean, there's a way in which you can tell the story, and they even have a pamphlet about it, in which it's just about how good the Spanish are, and it's a nice donation. That's nice. But in a way, you don't have to kind of go through the kind of very deep and complex history for the purpose of the organization itself. And that's something I really realized when engaging with the literature produced by the same organizations. I mean, more often than not, they have their kind of own their own books about their buildings. But I thought that that's where kind of looking at it as a scholar and with a little bit more degree of distance was important. And in that sense, I don't necessarily have a kind of conclusion of what kind of image I think this one is, this particularly dissonant or more resonant, but I have to go all the way to the back. But there's one image that I do use a lot in the book, and if I could use it as the kind of book cover, I would be very pleased. And it is this one. It was donated by Spain to the ILO building, and it's this classical kind of Pygmalion and Galatea myth. So, you know, Pygmalion is the sculpture maker who falls in love with his own statue, and then the statue comes to life. And I think this is just exactly what's happening. This is the kind of story of the book. It's like international organizations take themselves so seriously that they become then this kind of living statues. And what I'm trying to understand is why and how did they come to life in particular. I don't know if that answers the question.
No, it's wonderful. Thank you.
I have one question regarding the materiality of these buildings, because all these buildings were constructed using some materials. And I'm just curious, if you reach that point, of course, where these supplies came from, like what this like supply chain tell us about the hierarchies and the resource of these buildings?
No, just a very good example. So the marble to make the League of Nations Palace came from Italy. And that was fine until Italy got sanctioned by the League of Nations because of invasion of Ethiopia. And then it got very tricky because functionally the League was sanctioning itself, basically. I mean, you sanction Italy, but then you don't have the supplies to make the building. So that's a little kind of small example, but I think broader what I would say about like this different kind of instances is that in all of them, the question of the materials themselves are very, very local. So even if you have like international architects, although that doesn't happen in all the cases, most of the actual constructors are going to be local companies with kind of local regulations. And I didn't really go into that with too much detail. Even in the chapter, the whole part of the kind of Palais Entreprise that is created to build it, I don't go into too much detail. But at the end, you can see that there is a moment in which the kind of polity says, well, this whole international thing is so fun, but we're actually the ones who know how to do these things. And that is partially why all of these buildings are kind of very national at the end of the day. So, you know, New York, we have a skyscraper. Geneva, we have this monstrosity. Vienna is kind of the most Austrian thing ever. So in a way, that's how the kind of domestic or the national creeps into the idea of international.
Thanks for the amazing talk. So I was just thinking about the material you had on yesterday in terms of technology and also the exhibition spaces. So one is picking up on the materials for building questions is technologies for building, and so whether the extent to which new technologies were incorporated or not, and if not, why not? And the other would be the relationship between the World Exhibition buildings and this Parliament. And obviously the chief point here is that the exhibition building up the road was the site of Australia's first parliament here. So why certain kinds of buildings are seen as appropriate for parliaments and other kinds of buildings are seen as appropriate for commercial fairs, and the sort of there seems to be a different speed in the kind of the images you showed yesterday and the images of these buildings seem to be on a totally different temporal track as well as a different institutional track.
No, the first point about the expos is fundamental, and I regret not bringing more images for New York, but the point or where I start with the New York chapter really is that the kind of 1939 World Expo, World Fair in New York that I was talking very briefly about yesterday is really in a way a kind of dress rehearsal for the later United Nations, in particular because it is in those buildings in which the United Nations is going to function for a lot of its early part. I mean, we think a lot about the skyscraper, but obviously it was not built in one day like Rome. So actually the first four or five kind of meetings of the Security Council, General Assembly, happen in very random places throughout New York. And that's actually my chapter to the edited volume that you mentioned. What I wanted to highlight was the kind of placeholder, improvised interim spaces of international organizations. Not the very sexy ones that I had described that took a lot of time to think and do, but actually, where do we have the Security Council tomorrow? And it was a particular, for instance, the first meeting of the Security Council was in a gym of a kind of disused high school. And, you know, there was all sorts of jokes about that. But going back to your point, I mean, what I find very interesting is that the kind of first meeting place of many of the sessions of the General Assembly was the New York City building of the World Fair. So you had all the time delegates coming into that building and saying, well, how is this international? Like, we come into the building, it says the city of New York in the front. Well, how do we actually work with this? And in particular, Robert Moses, which is a kind of towering figure of the New York story and very studied in science and technology studies, he was adamant that the UN should stay in that ground in Lake Success and, let's say, Long Island, really, that's more precise, and not come to New York, to Manhattan itself. So there is a lot of kind of connections there. I tried to argue in that chapter. Also because, for instance, the kind of main architect of the Manhattan building, Wallace Harrison, had been very involved in the World Fair. The architects he would choose to work with were people who were in the World Fair. Oscar Niemeyer, for instance, who is this, I do have a picture of him, I think, with the kind of figure there in the right corner, Brazilian communist architect, very kind of different to all the others. Basically, he got in a way involved because Wallace knew him from the World Fair. He had done the Brazilian pavilion, and it's like, okay, that guy, even if it's a communist, it's like tolerable, it's a nice one, and fair enough. So that about that. The second point about technology, it's a good point. I mean, I think that when I started working on the project, I was kind of much adamant on this. For instance, I was much more interested in translation technologies because that's an enormous part of that. I think it's been well explored in relation to courts and, let's say, simultaneous translation in Nuremberg. There's good work on that, but my sense is that we didn't have that much good work on all of this. But I do have to say that when I kind of went into the project, I just found kind of the building itself and the kind of seating arrangements were kind of took more of the like kind of sunlight there. But I agree with you that kind of more detailed take would be on this technology. So, for instance, copy editing, memos, translating. There's a way in which one can take this a step further, definitely.
Yeah, thanks. Great work, Daniel, as I've heard before when we met before. I wonder if you want to say anything more about materialism, because you introduced the work with some focus on that. Obviously, you've written in that line. Do you think you're moving away from that? Or, I mean, you talked about the lived environment, the phenomenological dimension. You said something about what did some particular architect think at the time, which, you know, those are very non-traditional materialist lines, if it could be anyway. You talked about Foucault and materialism in relation to structuralism and or post-structuralism and or Foucault. There's a lot of very messy, complex, unfinished, undecided relationships there. I just wonder if you've got any more comments to make on where that's going, where that aspect of the work is going. Is it going towards a newly materialist vision in that sense, or are you trending away from it?
No, it's a good point, and I think I'm enjoying the kind of ambiguities of the materialist kind of tradition, because I find it's very productive that within that camp we can do like very kind of concrete supply and political economy kind of work, but also kind of very aesthetical work. And I myself oscillate widely throughout the project. But I think the place that I tried to like put my stakes in the ground more clearly, and that's why I went back, is this article published in the Journal of the History that was originally part of the master thesis, in which, for instance, just to put in relation with CLS and with James' work, what I try to do is to say, well, I think part of the problem is that we have been too obsessed with a particular CLS way of doing international legal history. And the way that I try to recover a kind of more materialist tradition is to think, well, what I call a materialism of the incorporeal, which is this kind of weird reference to Foucault in particular. So it's a kind of very Foucauldian materialism. But of course, there's a kind of enormous traditions maybe to the left of that, that then take maybe kind of structures even more seriously than I'm taking here. So I guess the reason why I wanted to foreground so much what particular kind of architects or statespeople do, are because I really felt that as I went through the materials, there was really a lot of contingency and serendipity. And this is not like a project about the celebration of contingency. We have having that conversation in the field, but I felt that coming to this and saying, well, because, you know, this was an imperialist project, then the building had to be this way, etc., which is what I felt that some of my more materialist colleagues in a particular vein would argue, didn't really add up with how confusing someone like Horta was. Like, Horta could have gone either way. So in a way, I think that as much as I want to do a very kind of structural argument of political economy, I also want to see the pressures in which these, you know, actors were involved and see the decisions they took, because I don't think they were necessarily overdetermined by the structures they were working in.
Can I ask a question connecting to that idea of values that come through or are represented in buildings? So in this Geneva chapter, I think you conclude by saying, for all its flaws, the Leagues Palais was the labyrinthic materialization of a particular vision of what the dignity of the League required. So can you talk us through this idea of dignity at the time? And I know you're not an architect, but can you talk to us about the process of translation of values into materials that happens when you're building buildings? And so how can we be more aware of this, I think, in a legal and also sort of contemporary context? Like, I feel like the current architectural language in legal institutions is around transparency, for instance. And so there's sort of this shift to glass and these this sort of embodiment of intention within material. So how did the dignity question play out? But also, where's that heading and what are the lessons learned, do you think, from this?
No, it's a very good point. I think that I was really drawn to dignity, of course, being familiar with Susan Marks' work on this, because I just saw it over and over in the Geneva sources. Just for instance, Eric Drummond, when he has to choose the kind of interim building where the League of Nations is going to function, his first thing is, we need a dignified building. And, you know, this used to be an old hotel, and it's nice, and, you know, it has an office that overlooks the lake. This is kind of a dignified location for us. And I think what they were trying to signal, especially in these kind of early moments of the institutions, is that because we never know if it was going to last, I mean, now we know that there's an UN and it's an institutional project and it's a century, etc. But I think in that moment they really thought, we need to look like a state, basically. If we're not taking with the same seriously as a foreign ministry, then what are we doing to begin with? And then actually when the ILO building is made, there's enormous source of comparison with foreign ministries throughout the world. So the Belgians coming and saying, well, our foreign ministry in Belgium is much more elegant. This is what's happening here. So I guess in a way what I was interested in is the kind of state-like function of this international organizations, and is embodied through the kind of architecture of itself. And I think that the Geneva building in that sense is very representative, because I think it does show a kind of old style vision of what a dignity of an institution entailed, that I think is very different from what's going to happen when all of this really becomes much more US Americanized. And there, as you said, I think questions of transparency, but I think above all of efficiency. Mm-hmm. Like, I think I'm a little bit in the minority here, but I think that some people really see the New York building as this kind of big victory of transparency. So Daniel Damla, and I know that some of your colleagues are working on this. My kind of take of Wallace Harrison, the kind of lead American architect involved in it, is that he's not a transparency person in any meaningful way. He's an efficiency person. He comes from winning the kind of Second World War. He kind of cut his teeth in the Rockefeller Center, which is another kind of Manhattan landmark. And he's thinking of how can we make a kind of Rockefeller Center for the international community as cheap as possible, as quickly as possible. But I don't think he is per se a kind of thinker of transparency. And then even Le Corbusier, which is someone who's read sometimes as a kind of figure of transparency, I don't really see that much. I mean, my kind of own reading of Le Corbusier, and he writes a lot, that's one of the most prolific architects writers in this tradition, is that when he really wants a lot of glass and kind of open spaces, it's all about human health. It's all about this kind of modern human having enough air and water and sunlight, and the new man, but not in a socialist tradition, in a kind of antecedent tradition to that. But I don't see him necessarily foregrounding transparency in a way. So I guess the question I would ask is, when did transparency really come into the mix into international organizations? I think that's later than we think. I mean, I buy the argument that transparency is central to German architecture. You know much more about it than I do. But even in Vienna, for instance, there's really not this drive towards a transparent institution. On the contrary, I think Vienna is one of the most opaque ones, especially because they're very concerned about terrorism and kind of infiltration of non-international elements into the building. So I guess what I'm trying to say is I would maybe resist a little bit the idea that we are so much about transparency. Maybe the ICC is, and maybe some places are in their own kind of weird histories, but I don't see the kind of post-shift. I see much more a shift towards efficiency and getting the job done and having good circulation more than a kind of aspiration of transparency.
Yeah, it's interesting.
Daniel, when you were talking about this, you were saying about taking it seriously. Mm. And my own bias for critical legal studies comes in, and it's very much that trashing approach where you take it as seriously as possible and what people put forward, but then you really, it's misused, but deconstruct what takes place, what you find. Is that going to sort of underpin a sort of methodological approach that you're following that sort of stream throughout? Because it seems like you're, with each chunk of the chapter, that you're then taking something else quite seriously on its own terms and then analysing it through this potential materialistic approach. Is that right for an understanding, or do you want to elaborate on that at all, or...?
Yeah, I mean, I think it is. And Alex knows this very well. We studied together in Bogota. I was kind of brought up in the CLS tradition. So it's kind of my default way of thinking in many ways. And especially the kind of trashing in terms of style, I find really, really kind of provocative. And it causes all sorts of conflict with colleagues in Europe, as you can imagine. But I love that. I mean, it's as a matter of style, I do adopt it. But I think that here I, and maybe this is the point I was trying to make before to Margaret, I was kind of really adamant on not putting the kind of the constructive horse before the cart.
Yeah.
Because what I didn't want this to read, and that's not a critique of that kind of work, I've done that kind of critique too, but what I didn't want this to read was, this is a 12 history of the UN Manhattan, whatever, or this is a feminist history of the Palais. It's like, no, this is a history of the Palais, and because I'm a Twailer and a feminist, then I read it in a particular way, but I didn't want that to be the subtitle, if that makes any sense.
I was just wanting to go to your comment when you said you're not an architect. And I just wondered if you had any reflections on that, about how you sort of engaged with those materials and the theories of architecture and all of those understandings, what it's meant for you and your project, but also perhaps your reception by that audience. You noted that one of your pieces had been published in an architecture journal.
No, a lot. I mean, it's been a struggle. And I was telling Mickey the other day that now, so I've always been in this awkward position between law and history of being two lawyer for the historians, two historian for the lawyers, and doing this just complicated everything, because now they're even worse, you know. So I applied recently to architecture postdoc and, you know, had a very nice time doing the application and everything, but it became clear that I had to have studied architecture to actually be eligible for it. So it reminds you that even if we all talk about interdisciplinarity, the kind of disciplinary kind of structures of all of this are something that one never kind of leave behind. And I really tried not to do that. I really still want this project to be legible to legal historians and to engage with architects and architectural historians in their own terms, but not necessarily to kind of disregard then kind of or canon or concerns. And that's why throughout the project, I really tried to stress how law plays such an important role in all of this. Architects are extremely litigious. I don't know what you think. Like Le Corbusier hired an international lawyer. I was like, this is just beautiful. And of course, that's the kind of things that architectural historians are maybe not as interested in. So I guess that the reply or the way of reply to this question is, whereas maybe an architectural historian would focus a lot on questions of style, and I think this goes a little bit to your question, and some colleagues working in this vein have focused a lot on style, I wanted to not give that too much weight. I mean, of course, it's important. Like Le Corbusier, Le Morin movement, we cannot say style doesn't matter. But at the end, I was trying to see more how do kind of jurisdictional disputes around style operate? How do legal disputes around style operate? And that's something I feel very confident analyzing as a legal historian, more than a kind of analysis of style or the work that style is doing. That said, I'm not really sure I want to continue working in architecture, but for now, it's been a fun run.
Oh, well, thank you, Daniel, for a really rich introduction to your discussion of your project, and thank you, everyone, for the discussion. Well done.
You've been listening to the ILLA podcast. To find out more, go to soundcloud.com/ILLAHpodcast. That's IILLAH podcast.